is a very significant step in a good direction, yeah. I think.
Yeah, the problem is that I give more priority now to the vertical sampling study that we're also working on, and I first want to make good progress with that before. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Who calling?
Oh, Georgia Poof.
Ah, okay. It's from Utah.
From Utah.
So yes, you're right. The budget is very limited, and we are a little bit disappointed by this, but. Of course, we try to get some more funding, but for the moment, this is all they can do. And maybe in the future, if they decide to go to the continuous mode, well, I come back to that one later, then maybe some more resources will become available, but we have to see that.
They are going to want a scientific alibi if we go in that direction, obviously.
Sorry, can you say that again?
They are going to want a scientific alibi for any decision to go in the direction of... Mm-hmm. That was very clear from the last outline.
Yeah, that's right, yes. Okay, let me go to the fourth slide. So this is the simulation that I'm planning to do. So we can use all the heritage from previous experiments that we did. So we did an ASSI for ADM in the past, in 2006. And you can find the details of that one in the paper that's... with the address I mentioned here. So this includes the retrieval of the Nature Run field from the ESMWF archive, the orbit simulation, interpolation software, and the simulation of the instrument error and the representativeness error. And this is done by the what we call LIPAS, the LIDAR Performance Analysis Simulator. And the details of this simulator are found in the web page that's mentioned on this slide. And we improved LIPAS, we're working on that now, because this is also part of the vertical sampling study. So we improved LIPAS that is compatible with the level 2B processor that's now under development. So another part is the representativeness error. And well, we did a study on the representativeness error for ESA the last couple of months. There is a big discussion going on between the burst and the continuous mode. And part of this study is to assess the representativeness error, because it's different when you sample a 50 kilometer or a 100 kilometer or 150 kilometer atmospheric track. So what we did, we looked at the model spectra of the ESMWF model, and you can see the picture. And what we found is that, it's not very surprising that the global models, they lose a lot of variance on the small scales. So the scales below 250 kilometers are generally not very well resolved by global models. And for as a comparison, I also displayed the K to the minus 5/3 spectrum that was found by Netram and Gage. And you can see indeed that, the scales below 250 kilometers, the model spectra are far below this Netram and Gage spectrum. This Netram and Gage spectrum is based on aircraft data, measurement data that they did in 1985. So the idea is that of course, the Nature Run that has been generated by ESMWF, ESMWF last year, that many, the small scales are not very well resolved by this Nature Run, and we have to take this into account if you want to do the simulation of ADM.
So did you check T511 Nature Run as well?
Not yet. That is the next thing I'm planning to do. Using the Nature Run fields, but I think the spectra. Well, Lars Isaksen, he made some spectra also for the T511, and it's quite similar to the T799. So not a very large difference. Only on the smaller scales, you see that the T799 resolves the scale slightly better than the T511. But it's
if I can make a comment here, I mean this. This figure was shown also at the APMAC in a different context where you were talking about, I think it was Ed talking about the studies that you had done regarding the possibility of a continuous mode of operation for ADM.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And it was quite controversial, especially the comment there on the right that the ECMWF model doesn't well resolve scales below 250 kilometers. We have a resident in the room who did a lot of validation of the nature run. So I'd be interested in his comment. But David Tan from ECMWF took exception to this comment, and he showed a number of simulations of very intense features that were appeared to be very well resolved, that had scales that were clearly below. So one thing is what you get out of the spectra, a different thing is what you get out of the phenomenology. There are some very intense storms that are actually very very well simulated by ECMWF that have smaller scales, so we have a bit of a conflict here.
Yeah, that's right. The ECMWF model does have smaller scales, but well, not as intense as found, for instance, also by scatterometer data. But I had a discussion with Otto about this, and from his studies, I understand that the scatterometer verified better with the buoys than with the model, and that's also an indication that well, the model does not resolve the small all the small scales very well. But you're right. There is a discussion going on, and at the ATMAC, I think we agreed that Van en Werken and Dave Offler would have a closer look at the document, and they will comment on this. So I think this is still an ongoing discussion.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It would be interesting to see, however, the same spectra for the T511, because our analysis of T799 showed actually that for smaller scales, surprisingly, it looked to be a little worse than T511. Mm-hmm. Especially in the tropics, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, you're talking about the verification of the spectrum. You're talking about the phenomenology.
The existence of feature, okay. Of course.
It's possible T511 shows better spectral characteristics.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised that there is some difference with the T511. And the other thing, however, that here looks quite interesting is that the lower levels are better represented than the higher levels. So this is a possibility also that it's not just a matter of the model, but is the fact that the upper troposphere, of course, we have much higher winds in the outer troposphere, so it's easier to make larger errors. So in that sense, it's not that you are resolving the scale at 250. The 1,000 millibar level looks quite well represented, at least until 50 kilometers. So it's a matter of representativeness of various levels, which maybe should be also discussed.
This is Dave. When we were working with the T106 way back in the early 90s, we took the grid point values for variability in the model and then used the von Karman kind of -5/3 to get all subgrid scale variance in there.
Yeah.
And every time, now T213, we do the same thing. We found out that we weren't getting any further ahead on it. So we still do that with the T213. With the 511, we're finding the same thing that you're seeing for the T799, is that if we want to represent the variance down on the, say, the 50-kilometer or the 100-kilometer integration line, we have to build that in by taking the grid point variance and cascade it down, because it's just not there. So we find the same thing. I think it's amazing. We used Nestrom and Gage 1985 as well, and we haven't found a way to update that to get at those high level, just like the 100, 250 level. You know, I don't know of any other data sets that were taken for these very long baselines of good resolved wind variance. I think it's amazing that we're still referencing a 1985 paper.
That's right. Yes. Well, what we have.
I don't know anything better either.
We have some data at KNMI that a colleague of mine is looking into now. Maybe this will contribute to the Nestrom and Gage data set. But you're right. As far as I have seen in the literature, I cannot find any newer results from this.
Anyway.
Okay, so shall we go to the next slide?
Yes, okay. So this is some simulation issues. that I think are very important if we want to do a fair comparison between the results of our simulations and simulations from other groups, then at least the boundary conditions, let's say, should be the same. So for the clouds, for instance, well, what we have from the nature run is the cloud cover and some cloud optical cloud properties like liquid water and ice water content, for instance. And the question is, of course, how to translate this into the probability of hitting a laser of hitting the cloud and simulating the cloud backscattering extinction from these model dates. And well, I think that Dave did a lot of work on this, so I think his next presentation will highlight some of these aspects. But well, before we do the simulations, of course, we have to agree as a team how to simulate, or how to use the clouds in our simulations. And the same is more or less true for the aerosols. How do we simulate the backscatter and the extinction? In the past, we used a reference model for the ESA simulations. It was based on LiDAR data made by Michael Vaughan in the late 80s. But of course, nowadays we have much, much better data from Calypso, for instance, and from ISAT. So the question is, can we use this data and how should we do it? And this takes into account the variability along track. So how do we simulate the variability along this 50-kilometer track of ADM? And also the vertical variability, like stratification, etc. So, yeah, these are quite some issues that we have to agree on as a group, I think, before we can do the simulations.
This is just for my information. What is actually in the nature one? Is that a climatological aerosol field, or
nothing?
Or there's nothing there.
There's nothing in the nature one, as far as I know.
Okay. Not even climatology. I mean,
no, there is climatology.
They have to have something.
There is climatological aerosols.
Yeah,
we wrote it in our paper. I remember that Dr. Vieri corrected me on that. I thought that there were not, but he said that it was climatological aerosols.
Aerosol is one thing. Backscatter is another.
Yeah.
So just, you need to know a lot more about the aerosol than just aerosol. I mean, right. We can get, it's better than nothing. Yep. It helps to answer some of these questions that Gerrit Jan's bringing up about the variability and the structure of that variability, the clumpiness of it, or how it correlates over certain distances. That helps. We use water vapor to give us that correlation in one function. But as most people have heard us talking now for years, we kind of beg the issue on the exact aerosol loadings and do the bracketing. He said, What if it were all background aerosols, strictly sulfates, pretty much limited to the boundary layer and clouds? That's what we call the background mode, and you just assume that everywhere. Then you take the enhanced mode, which has been supported by a number of field campaigns, and you say, what if we had the enhanced mode everywhere? And then you look at the difference, and you see if there's anything significantly different. It drives you then into trying to do a better job. And I, this is a big challenge.
And if there's no difference, you just don't worry about it.
You don't worry about it. But there is a difference, particularly in vertical coverage. And so this is a challenge. I think you put it on the table, a number of challenges, and I don't know. I'm still sticking with bracketing, but I'm looking and watching someone else to work.
Is that
a dynamic aerosol, not a climatology of aerosol, but a dynamic aerosol?
Is that as much of an issue for a direct detection system like ADM as it is for the coherent?
Well, direct has both the aerosol and molecular channels, so...
Yeah, but the vertical coverage...
if they don't have aerosols, they have molecular.
They have the molecular, whereas a coherent wouldn't have that.
Right, but the hybrid does.
The hybrid does, yeah. But still, in your hybrid experiments, this was very sensitive because you want to attribute the coverage to the correct system. Give the credit where credit is due. Whereas here, there's only, it's basically a molecular system.
Yeah. Arlindo da Silva of GMAO is planning to simulate aerosol from nature run.
Actually, I can add something on this. We had a very long summer in which we were supposed to do a paper on NAMMA. And trying to put the effect of the aerosols on tropical suppression. and he made this run with this...
He made Arlindo?
Arlindo, yes, someone, basically with the interactive aerosol component. And unfortunately, it doesn't work yet, in the sense that it does not produce any result at this time. It's just noise. And so obviously it has to be, you know, developed. And it was very disappointing because we had this long integration with a lot of CPU time, but it's not ready. It's a product that might take several, maybe, I think several years to be delivered and to be usable, honestly. I was very disappointed about the fact there's no impact, basically, whatsoever. So the control run had no aerosol. There was this aerosol run, and there's tremendous computational effort and nothing, basically, whatsoever.
So control run, aerosol run, means what?
There were two sets of data simulation, okay? Mm-hmm. From these, there were a set of 35-day forecast done over the NAMA period, yeah. Control and aerosol. And at this time, we weren't able to find any impact from this aerosol routine, which was very computationally expensive, but unfortunately was not really doing anything to the dynamics at this time. So it's I would be cautious before, you know, thinking that...
I don't understand. What did you do? You did real data, right?
Real data, yeah. This was to overlap NAMA period. So if that doesn't work in the real world, you know, the simulation of aerosol is even more, you know, under question. We really need to be able to have a routine that allows to really detect that.
But if Arlindo simulate aerosol just to give right kind of sampling for LiDAR, it may be good enough?
Well, again, as I said, we could use this to be phenomenologically correlated. I mean, if you have convective pumping and it's pumping a lot of aerosols out of the boundary layer, and if I have a chance, I'm going to show you what we got with typhoons this summer, flying it on an airplane. We had returns, unbelievable returns, below 3 kilometers in regions where I thought we should be seeing the background mode, which is pretty much nothing except within the marine boundary layer. Well, having something which captures that in a Aussie would be useful at least in organizing the aerosols. Now, to get at a backscatter coefficient and all the extinction terms, I mean, that's a step, but it would be helpful. I want to mention something here, and then I don't have to mention it later, is that Dave Winker and I, and also Dave Battle from the University of Alabama, Huntsville, have been funded now to take the Calypso data and work this issue of how much of, you know, where is the background mode, where is the enhanced mode, how is it tied to phenomena, so that not just a global climatology, but a phenomenology. So when we go to an Aussie, we can perhaps slave that to some model metrics and yet put in values that we find from Calypso. We're funded to do this. It's a long shot, but if it works, we'll have something that may be equally useful as some of these other efforts. But I don't know how else to say it, Gerrit-Jan. This is it's a challenge, and amongst all the challenges, I don't know. I think the clouds are a bigger challenge.
Yeah, I fully agree. These are big challenges, and we do not have the
resources.
Right answer on the table how to exactly do it, so we really have to think about it. I'm not quite sure what the schedule is of the Aussies, the experiments, when the simulated ADM data are needed for the simulation. So is there any deadline when we should bring up our government LiDAR simulations? Or
I think what do you think about deadline?
Well, we're not really ready to do any Aussies yet, but we're getting there. We had an Aussie meeting, when was this, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah. I think
where Ron Erico was showing the calibration experiments being done in GMAO, and they were very, very impressive in my view.
Yeah, I think so.
So there's a lot of, we're not that far away from having a system that's actually ready to do true Aussies. Early 2009, I think it could be up and running.
So the calibration experiments with the conventional data are already on the way.
And the radius data.
What Ron showed was adjoint sensitivity analysis of experiments with all the reference observations in there. So the whole current simulated observing system, and he showed the data impacts averaged over a month and how they stack up with the average of a similar month in a true real forecast situation. And the comparison is really good. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's good.
The only thing is cloud track wind. Simulated cloud track wind is too optimistic.
Yeah, it has too much impact.
And that's Dave Emmett and Chris Belden has been working on this, but what long they do, just simple interpretation. So that is too naive.
You mean too much impact relative to the real data counterpart?
Yes,
that's right.
Yes.
Because that may be because the real data counterpart is not giving them enough weight or whatever.
No, the assimilation systems are the same.
Yeah.
So it's
weights.
So it's because the way they're being simulated is too optimistic compared to.
Well,
yeah. I made a summary from last meeting, and toward the end of last meeting, Yoshiaki made a comment about too optimistic cloud track wind, and cloud track wind has so much problem in height assignment. And speed, slow bias, and all kind of things. Simpson
right.
has studied, but none of these problems is not maintained to.
The question I'm asking about is what cloud motion vectors were used in that?
Yeah.
Everything from Meteosat, from GOES, from MTSAT-1R, and from MODIS. So the same that are being used in operations.
But they weren't simulated then?
No, they were sampled. They were not. They didn't go in. I mean, you can't simulate them yet because that would require you to have a model that would generate at the resolution of the images.
But I do, and we get the slow bias.
Yeah, but we don't have that on the global.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Okay.
So they were just sampled. You know, you take a set of realistic location, you sample the wind field there, you add error to it, and that's too optimistic.
Yes, we agree because it has no bias. If it had a bias, which we get when we simulate it from the nature run, we get the 1.5 meter per second slow bias. In fact, that's in one of the presentations today, but I'm going to go through this fast. But the error, the height assignment error, according to Chris and some others who have been working on this for quite a while, of the 4 to 7 meter per second observation error that's assigned to those, depending upon where they came from, at least three of them, 3 meters per second is due to the height assignment.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so that one is a little harder to simulate, but we do that. We do. But once you start putting all those errors on, I don't have any study that's shown the pluses and the minuses because we really haven't done an Aussie where the cloud motion vectors were in there. Quite honestly, all those bracketing Aussies that have been presented at meetings and so forth had no cloud motion vectors.
Well, it's included, but 93 levels is almost nothing.
Nothing.
So, exactly. So that is known problem. So it's possible we can remove the cloud motion vector for the LiDAR also. That's possibility.
No, I think what we should do. No,
everything.
We need to have them in there because they have a fairly large impact in both. So you can't just take them out. That diminishes.
Yeah.
What we should do is, the stuff that Dave is talking about now is well known and it's not difficult to simulate. You just have to realize that you need to put it in there.
Plus, I just gave a paper in New Caledonia on the synergisms between Doppler wind LiDAR and cloud motion vectors and ocean vector winds, because that height assignment could come from the LiDAR. Just as we're looking at Calypso height assignments on cloud motion vectors right now.
Sure.
So if you take that out, the impact could go up. I was just more asking about what this test was that showed them to be too good, and I understand now why it would be too good.
So who has the lead to simulate the errors in that?
It's Ron Arapo is doing this, and they're not here, so
he's not truly simulating them, but he's
sampling
them. Sampling.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, right now he's putting random errors in.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah. And it's that bias.
And what you could do is you could add a level of noise to the level where you sample them. You say, okay, I'm going to sample this at 100 millibars plus minus 50 millibars, and I'm going to put it in at 100.
Well,
or whatever.
That's a kind of a random error.
Yeah, we need
and
a systematic.
Then you would have to bias at
we
the end
do it by the
thing,
depth of the cloud.
Okay.
So if the cloud's thin, then you get a pretty good height assignment. But if it's thick, you give a height assignment to about the middle of the cloud, which are, if you have shear, if you have no shear, there's no problem. But if you have shear, which is often air, then you get, lo and behold.
Well, how do you do something to get reasonable clouds? I know we've
sure,
been over this.
Sure, from taking the model moisture fields, the ice, liquid water content, we get thick cirrus, thin cirrus, opaque, all those classes.
That are consistent with nature.
Yeah, and then we look at that. We look at that and compare that with, in fact, that's one of the things we're using Calypso to do, is to give us a comparison on our cloud climatologies in terms of thickness, physical thickness, tops and bottoms.
I mean, I'll be happy to talk to Ron about this, because I think for the wind LiDAR in particular, it's important.
You cannot
take them out. Yeah. And we're asking about the impact of a wind system here above and beyond what other wind observations are in there. So
you have to have to
agree. Yeah.
So that's the agenda, but all the mechanism is there. We still need tuning, but everything is...
Every nature run requires new tuning, because the cloud representations are different as you scale down. And we've done it for the 511, but now we're sitting there yet to do the 799.
So deadline is we have to like to have an impact on future planning. So,
well, fortunately, NASA is not going to plan to fly this for another 10, 15 years, so we have plenty of time.
But if we I'm just wondering, if we can produce good result, is that speed up the planning?
Good results? What are good results?
Good result means that this is going to be great.
Oh, that result.
It will have an impact, and it certainly, well, I don't know that it would have an impact on the European side. I think what will really have an impact there is seeing ADM fly and give
I think the deadline is more like audience, and the people get, if we just talking about nature and evaluation and planning, people will give up on listening to OSI.
That's why I think
that is a deadline.
That's why I think the other use of OSSIs in preparing us to best use and optimally use the data ADM data for the first go is in play here, being ready. Plus these synergisms I talk about. I'm working with Dave Long at Brigham Young, who's processing scatterometry down to 6 kilometers, and I'm going out second week in January, and we're going to be doing some more work on this. It's quite exciting because the LIDAR, we're using the aircraft LIDAR with scatterometer data to show that those ambiguities are, when you remove them, the effect goes out 500 kilometers. The effect of correcting it at one point. And so, in some cases, 1,000 kilometers. Same goes for cloud motion vectors. We haven't looked at this. What if you get the height assignment right of this field of clouds? It's giving you vectors. It's giving you convergence, divergence features, but putting them all at the wrong height. Now you put them at the right height by the LIDAR, you get the benefit of the other structure and other flow that it's revealing. So these synergisms need to be explored as well as just looking at cloud motion vector winds as competition for LIDARs or scatterometers competition, they're actually going to help each other.
Yeah, that's what we have to emphasize. So if LIDAR is up and quality of cloud motion vector will go up, scatterometry.
Yeah.
For the simulation of the LIDAR winds, did you simulate the hybrid winds for the hybrid instrument?
Yeah, we're doing that. In fact,
so anyway, coming back to the discussion, that would really be a help on this side of the Atlantic if we showed a nice positive impact from GWAS, the hybrid LIDAR. Mm-hmm. But as far as Peter said, it needs to be in the context of the baseline observing system, which is everything.
Right.
Are you everybody having a GWAS on these kind of things? Everybody know. So it's not that specific deadline, and we really have to get something to present early next year. So people get fed. Otherwise, people will get up, fed up with this.
Yeah, we need to keep it going. So early 2009 would be a good time.
So any result, then we can start to tuning. Then if we can get to OSI before ADM also before ADM launched, and its result is confirmed, but after ADM,
that's ADM is being helpful to us here because the launch is slipped to October 2010.
October 2010?
Yes. That was the launch date, as we heard it at the October.
So, if we prepare the OC for the ADM before ADM data become available,
that,
say
would,
ADM
that would be helpful for us here, who, as Dave said, for the operational estimation. Yeah, for INSEP and Navy and ESMWF and the Met Office, whoever wants to.
Yeah, and also I'd like to use up this NatureRun quickly, because model development is so fast. Even European Center current operational model is maybe 5 or 7 generations down from what we have. So if we don't hurry up, everything gets obsolete very quickly. So that's the kind of data, right? Can we go to next final last slide? Hello?
Yes.
Yes.
The last slide, yes, it's on now?
Yeah. 7?
Yeah, so this is, well, as you may have heard, and Lars Peter can also give you the details if you like, that the continuous mode is on the table again. It's currently under a big discussion at ESA, and I think that the final decision will be made more or less these days, next couple of weeks. And I guess that if the continuous mode will be selected after all, then there will more funding become available, and also ESA will be more interested in doing new experiments, for instance, with the joint OSSI. I think the reason why they're not really interested at this stage to do an ADM OSSI is because ADM is selected already, so it will not bring up a new news in the context of mission selection, those kind of things.
Yeah, but we can, if once we done the ADM OSSI, we can do OSSI for the follow-up mission.
Yeah, I think that's an important one, because we're already looking ahead of ADM, and if we want to make some recommendations to EUMETSAT for post-ADM scenarios, it would be great, of course, if you could test these scenarios within the OSSIs. And it seems that EUMETSAT is maybe willing to fund this kind of studies, but this is still under discussion between us and the EUMETSAT people, so...
And if we had had an OSSI system ready and running today, we could have had an impact on this continuous mode operations discussion.
That would have been great, of course.
Because
yes.
As you recall, Kretjan, we were talking back and forth for 2 hours in Nordvik about this without really getting anywhere, because David Tan said, no, this is off the table, and as Stoffman said, yeah, this is a good idea. And you can't just reason your way out of it. If you can't reason your way out of this in 2 minutes, 2 hours isn't going to make any difference. And,
sure.
And it didn't. It's one of these issues that kind of comes out of nowhere. We thought this discussion was settled 6 or 7 years ago. It comes at you again, and it would have been great to have an experimental tool and say, okay, we'll just run the thing with in both modes of operation and see what the difference is. As it is now, you're probably right, they're taking the decision right round about now, but they will still want to see an impact of what they decided if they decide to go to continuous mode.
Japan, JMA was not involved in it directly, but they had GEM-CDL, which is the Japanese module on the space station, CDL, Coherent Doppler LiDAR, funded me to look at the continuous versus burst mode with 2 looks. And we did that. Now, that belongs to them. And I was with them a couple weeks ago, and they're starting a conversation again. But we did look at running continuous mode versus burst from the space station, which surprised me, because I thought space station had lots of power. But yes, it has lots of power, but it uses lots of power. So the margin of power available is still somewhat limiting. And I can tell you that it all depends on which model you use for your impacts as to whether it makes a difference. Clearly, in the global scale, it wasn't clear. But when you looked at smaller scale models being used in typhoon work, then it could, of course, and you can imagine that.
But that was two looks. It basically used two fixed telescopes, GEM-CDL did, and the question was whether you run them continuous or on a duty cycle. So there's been a little probing of that, but I'm not sure it's useful to your discussion. I just let you know it happened. But
This is ultimately going to be driven by a technical constraint.
Oh, yeah. That's why I'm curious that going from 25 to 100%, I thought it was a power budget issue.
Well, it's actually almost a one-to-one. I can talk to you about this offline afterwards. So I don't want to derail the discussion.
And another deadline is I have to test NSF data simulation code for LiDAR data. But right now, only data available is the 1993 OC data, so simulated data. So I have to use that data. So that's old. Rest of the things are all. Everything is very old. I still have to get back to 1993 also, unless I get new simulated LiDAR data from either from KNMI or Simpson weather. That's.
We have little bursts of it. What do you want to use it for?
Oh, just test the core.
Oh, well, we have that. We're just not going to turn the crank on. We use hundreds of gigabytes when we're done with this stuff if we go through the whole T799 and the T511.
Yeah.
So we just have little chunks of data just to look at.
Okay. So that's kind of thing I need.
Oh, just to test code. Oh.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. That's great.
Both 511 and T799?
T511.
T511. All right.
Okay. So can we go to Dave Evans' talk?
Okay, are you done?
So, Guardian, is there anything you'd like to say?
No, well, the only thing is that I will attend the meeting in the next LWG meeting in Destin, so that's another opportunity to discuss all these issues.
Yes.
And also visit the meeting in June next year.
Okay.
Okay, great.
All right.
Which file are you going to be working off of?
All right, I'm going to start with simulating EWL winds and CMBs.
For Guardian?
Okay, gotcha.
Okay. I'm going to jump around here. I'm not going to show all the slides at all. They're there for your reference if you wish. Just a minute.
Hello, can I check who is on the phone? Georgia, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. Is Eric there? No.
Okay, I don't have time to show all these slides. Like I said, I do want to take you off to our website at Simpson Weather, where you can at least see how well we've documented what we do on the clouds, on subgrid scale variance, on aerosols, all of that is there on the website. I want to bring you all the way up to date to what we did in August and September and part of October, flying typhoons, and how we're going to use the data we took in data assimilation studies, and also to simulate the, and by thinning it, simulate what ADM will see with these very long, multi-thousand kilometer legs, and what we would see if we had two perspectives, because we collected the data in two perspectives, in fact, 12 perspectives. So I want to end up there, because that's sort of the mode we're in, is taking real data, Calypso data, real airborne wind LiDAR data, and looking at our OSSI simulations and seeing how realistic we are. Not necessarily to make them more realistic, but to put checks on our enthusiasm about how we interpret them. There's no point in trying to be perfect in these OSSIs. We can't. That's why we're putting an instrument up to find out what it's really like. But I think if we have some idea where we can trust the OSSIs and where we have to put some reservations on them, that's worth pursuing that. Otherwise, we could be misled. So, quickly, I'm on the second slide. The overview here is I'm going to just discuss the DLSM. This has been around since the late 80s. It started actually down at Marshall Space Flight Center and then was carried back up to Simpson Weather, and it's been funded by the DOD, NOAA, and NASA over all those years. So the DLSM
used to stand for Doppler LIDAR, and then it was DOD LIDAR, and whatever you want the D to stand for. I'm going to go to that website in a minute. I'm also going to talk about SIBO, which is a NASA program. We've been working on that for a year and a half. We've got another, I guess, year or so to go on this. This is a sandbox that's been set up that we use the DLSM on. It's remote. It's in Charlottesville, but it's running on an Apple, on a 3 processor, I believe, or 4 processor. And it's transparent to the user up at NASA that he's running the model actually down there. And that's working. And we're doing some adaptive targeting. I'll show you a video of some adaptive targeting ideas of when we come up over hurricanes. Remember, this is a sandbox. We're looking at sensor web concepts. But the model's being used there. We also are looking at calibration of the DLSM using GLASS and Calypso. We already completed GLASS 2 years ago. We're now funded to work on Calypso. This is looking at cloud-free line of sights. Some of the backscatter, Calypso can't dig into the backscatter cross-sections that we have to be sensitive to. It gets close, but there's at least an order of magnitude and sometimes two orders of magnitude that the wind LIDAR will pick, will be sensitive to where Calypso isn't. So we've got to be careful in trusting Calypso to give us all of that information, but it gives us some pretty good clues, and I think we've come up with a way to work with it that allows us to extrapolate a little bit. The role of temperature in wind LIDAR work only applies to the direct detection, doesn't apply to the coherent, and it's an effect on direct detection that we look at and we use. It's not a strong effect, but when you're trying to work your way down to the sub-meter per second accuracies, you have to take temperature into account. And then simulating ADM in preparation for assimilating ADM data. This is a ROSES 7. Effort that's been funded, Lars Peter as PI, I don't know what I am, COI, and it's a 3-year project to prepare for ADM, but it's actually to look at over the horizon after ADM. So we're going to explore some of the post-ADM concepts, and we're free to explore almost anything we can come up with. So,
well, recall that we were sliced pretty brutally.
Yes.
In budget, and what you are saying now was true for the original proposal, but it was narrowed down to focus more on GWAS, actually, more on the U.S. system.
Right.
That's more in line with what Ramesh is interested in, and I had to cut some stuff out of it to justify going down to 38% of the proposed budget.
Yeah, I didn't mean we were going to explore all the ADM and ADM technology-based options. We're talking about what happens if you fly GWAS.
But it's in that time frame, you're right.
Right, yeah. And with ADM follow-ons flying, and what would be the role of a GWAS or an NWAS, a GWAS in the beginning. So, quickly, this is what we've been doing for quite a few years, the wind LIDAR and also the cloud motion vectors. This slide is simply showing you the history of our effort. It started with the T-106 and back in 89 and up through the current ones. Cloud motion vectors, we began that in 03, and we've done T-511 looking at it, but we have not done T-799 for cloud motion vectors. The model is mainly looking at space-based, but the model does have an airborne component. It used to have a balloon-borne component, and still does, but we don't use it. So it really is trying to simulate any LIDAR on any platform. We use the Nature Run as the input. We've used MM5 as an input. We've used the global models as inputs. We then have to generate the optical properties. Now, the clouds provide some of that, but the aerosol side, we have not had that in the model as a grid point value, so we have to add that. And the atmospheric optical properties are a big part of our effort. And subgrid scale turbulence has been a challenge for a long time in the beginning, and we're pretty comfortable with the way we do it. We've looked at some other data to see if we're reasonable, and we are, but there's always ways to improve it, like Garrett Yon brought up. I mean, as you look at different models or if you look at different altitudes, the subgrid scale variance that we see out there in the real world, albeit not with too many experiments, is different. So we have to adjust to that because of our sampling. We're less than 10 meters sampling diameters, spaced pretty far apart. And so there's a lot of variability that you hope by taking lots of samples in 50 kilometers or so that you're going to beat down that variance. Rod Frelich and I and basically the two of us have worked hard to show how that works using ground-based LIDAR. And we now use some of what Rod and I have come up with on that. So we keep nudging this toward more and more realistic subgrid scale variance representation. But we can't kid ourselves. It's not in the model, and we have to simulate it. I'm not going to spend time on this. You've seen these pretty pictures. You know what our coverage in the vertical is going to be for coherent. GWAS is a hybrid system. Cloud motion vectors, I don't want to repeat too much of what I said, but 3 to 5 meters per second is random, and the bias was 1.5 meters per second. That's what we're getting, and that's what we provided, but we never really used in the T213 nature run Aussies. Those were never really used that I know of. And so, but we're generating them, and we've worked with Chris Velden on this as well to get sanity checks. And each time we get a new nature run, we have to change it because we get so many more vectors than what we really get from satellites. And you have to adjust it for Meteosat, the Japanese. Each one has their own error or characteristic issues. So I'm going to, we get speed bias. I'm going on down to 20 now. And right now we are simulating realistic and proposed wind LIDAR concepts for use in SIVO and NCEP Aussies. We're now working on the new Nature Run 511 and T799.
What's the difference between the SIVO?
SIVO's still running T213 because we're getting on with experiments.
You mean 1993?
Yeah. We're using that to get a sniff of how you would do trades, and I'll show you some of those. I mean, there's no point in waiting. We're going to do the T213, then when we get the higher resolution models ready, we'll use those. All right? So we're moving forward with still T213. We're simulating cloud motion vectors for SIVO and for NCEP, and we're simulating various ADM follow-on missions. That's, by that I mean we're in the, part of that's been done in one cycle, there are many, many cycles on these things. We're not turning the crank on the recent nature runs because the volume of data is enormous. So we do have some snippets to give you if that's all you want to do is check your code. So let me go to the website.
Hello.
All right, this is the Simpson Weather website. I don't want to spend any time here. If you're there, Tom or others, you can click on that.
Could you read that?
It's in the slides.
Ah, okay.
It's in the slide. It's actually a hyperlink. If the hyperlink doesn't work, you can see it.
Works fine for me, Dave.
Okay, and then you just click on the picture, just anywhere on that picture, and you get to the next level, which has the overview, the experiment, the shot coverage, simulation, analysis, graphics, examples, file, all that stuff is there. If you go down to LSM technical document, you get into issues of how we handle shot coverage, how we handle model atmospheres, Doppler LIDAR winds, line of sight. Let's go to atmospheric variables, and we here document how we handle optical properties, cloud models, turbulence models, terrain models. It's all right there. So if you want to go down to optical properties, we reference where we get the information, the wavelengths we're working at. As you dig down in here, you'll see more and more, more and more graphics. All this could be updated, but the documentation on the DLSM is online. It grows with time. It tells you how we, particularly the subgrid scale variance, how we use the Nostrum gauge data, how we use the von Karman. We still use that to get at subgrid scale variance that is consistent with the variance at the larger scale that the model's presenting. So if you take nine grid points at a level, we take 9, 9, and 9, all right, so we have 27 grid point values to give us the variance that the model's suggesting on that scale, and then we cascade that down to the finer scale. All right, we have other options that are simpler and less computationally demanding, but that's the way we do it in the final analysis. So I really don't want to spend much more time on that, because you can pick any one of these things and talk about it, but it's there. If you want to look and see how we have been doing it, if there's something critical, you should call us, because sometimes we haven't updated this in terms of the optical properties in particular. Because we are upgrading them as we do the glass analysis and the Calypso analysis.
Is everybody together with this website he's looking at? Okay.
Yes, I have it in front of me now, yes. I think it's very interesting, so I will have a closer look at the next couple of days.
Okay.
Okay?
We've got it here in Boulder.
All right.
So now that you have it, I'm going to move on because we don't have too much time, but I just want to let you know that it's there to look at, and I would like to go on to talk a little bit about what we're doing with SIVO, which is the parallel effort for the Aussie effort, or I should say Aussie-like effort. So I'm going to go to now. NSEP Seabloom. NSEP Aussie Seabloom, okay? Again, I'm not going to show all the slides. In fact, I decimated this a little bit from the original. But at NASA, Goddard, Lars Peter is part of that group, and me as well, and a number of other people. And I'm surprised Lars Peter's name isn't on here.
Well, I was part of the group, but I really haven't been to any of the meetings for the last year and a half, so I think that's why I dropped off of this thing.
Well, still, he's in the background. But we've been working on this idea of a sensor web, where the looking ahead to the future, where instruments are talking to each other. And they're telling, for instance, the LIDAR where the best use of those shots might be, looking ahead. Cloud coverage, cloud holes, scatterometer structure on the sea surface. We'd like to have winds. And the concept that I'm going to show you right now is, what if it isn't right underneath the satellite? What if we slew it like we can do, and we slew the whole system and take our cone of regard and move it off to the left so we get more symmetrical coverage or maybe direct coverage of a phenomenon on the ground? We're not proposing that. We're just setting ourselves up with the ability to look at those questions. And so right now it's operational. You can run things at Goddard, and you're actually running the model. You can run the model down at our place, and it generates data. And what's not there right now is the impact part of it. But simulating the observations is there, okay?
So data simulation is GMAO?
Yes.
Same system as GMAO?
Yes.
Possibly a little bit older.
Yeah, and there, that isn't in place yet. Particularly the line of sight assimilation. That's a sore point. We're still producing U and V component winds for them, and the line of sight assimilation is not moving forward. But the team members here, I don't know why it's coming out like this, but it's quite a good team of mainly technologists, but there you are. Lars, you're on there.
Yeah.
But it's heavy on the concept of a web and communication, information exchange, uploading, downloading. I've had this idea of having the model in space, if bandwidth's a big issue, but however it is, it's one instrument and talking to other instruments in near real time, not going down to the ground and handing up a command hours later. All right, so that's what we're looking at. And the role of a DWL in that sensor web is one of the first things we're looking at. So it's a model-driven, all right, we're getting into adaptive targeting, models telling sensors where they need help, ensemble kinds of things.
as well as ICATS, which I call it, which is initial condition adaptive targeting. The example I'll show you is that, where the laser is validating the model along a line of sight only. And if it doesn't validate, then it goes into a full resolving mode. A lot of these are predicated on not having enough power on the platform to support 100% duty cycle to look so, everywhere you ever wanted to look.
So they don't call it OC. What's the difference between our OC and the sensor web?
Well, let's say, what's the difference between the simulations? Nothing. What's different in the OSCEs is that the impact would be on a NASA model rather than the NSAT. That's the only difference.
Well, I mean, this is a much more complicated
We're looking
system here.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about.
We're not talking about something we're going to build even in the next 10 years. We're just talking about looking at how instruments talk to each other and how you communicate and how that information helps other instruments do their job better. It's an optimization thing.
Yeah.
And it's also looking at the issue of bandwidth. They're really focusing on how to support this kind of mission, not whether it should fly or not, but how would you support that kind of mission?
So we have to coordinate a little bit about the GMAO sensor web.
The project goals are to demonstrate, I'm on now slide number 4, to demonstrate the value of implementing sensor web concepts for meteorological use cases. Also looking at cost savings to missions. You know, a lot of motherhood statements here. But progress is being made, and it's here on slide number 5. You guys won't be able to do it, and I see that I'm going to... I can't either because...
I'm sorry, sometime...
The version of the slide didn't come up with... I can't even show you the movie. So we'll just go on.
So I hope you can make your movie work in some computer.
No, you won't, because...
Is that... Movie is not attached.
No. That's why I thought I'd be using mine. It's okay. What this movie shows, which is slide number 5, is a simulation of the wind LiDAR, GWAS. This is GWAS with the 4 looks. And it's moving along, and it's coming up over a storm, and it swivels, it slews, and gives better coverage, and then slews back. That's all it is. We haven't done the impacts on it. This is just eye candy. But it's just giving you an example of the sorts of concepts we're exploring. What's the advantage of that? We do know some of the work that Bob Atlas and I did, and we did some OSCEs on this. We showed the value of having symmetric coverage of a cyclone versus only having one side. Okay, and the impact difference was significant. So this is addressing that suggestion that if you come up over a cyclone and you want symmetrical coverage, if it's only off to the port side, and that's all you have, and you're only going to capture that side, you could rotate and get so much more impact. This would be making the case for it that it's technologically possible. Plus, if the instruments are telling each other when to do it, where to do it, then you don't have to worry about the ground delays and so forth.
But
so,
I when I did a similar experiment, the impact wasn't spectacular.
I take issue with that. I thought it was significant for the situation in hand. It wasn't global. If you dilute it by the global impacts, it's nothing. But if you look at the hurricane itself,
okay.
If you just say it's track, how well did you do in doing a better track forecast, it made a difference. But when you bury it and dilute it by a global impact, you don't see those things very well at all.
But for mid-latitude systems, I mean, could be even global. Because the asymmetric sampling, that's something we did try with a completely different problem with AIRS from the real data with an OIC. And it was amazing how there is a negative impact, actually. If you sample very densely, very large, 500 millibar cutoff only on one side, instead of having double coverage, you get a negative impact in the forecast. Very, very strong on the entire northern hemisphere. So I assume that this for the wind would be even more important, and even for the mid-latitude, not necessarily for tropical system.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So... I'm not going to show or go over any more of these slides other than to simply say that If you go to slide number 10, we really do need a line of sight operator to get the simulation done in the most efficient way. We just delivered a whole set of UV to SIBO, but we lose a lot of information because when you have no matching shot, you get nothing. But there's still information content in a single line of sight. We never argued against that, but we're losing that. So these are what we're these are some of the things that we're doing to.
When you provide UV, what in other words, you essentially convert your line of sight simulations to
UV. We have two. Yeah, we have two.
So components. In other words, you just give two components of a line of sight.
No,
no, we actually go in and do a UV, and then there's errors associated.
But I mean, the instrument won't really do that.
No, it just gives you two lines of sight that are into the same volume. It's like having, you know, the anemometer that.
Oh, two lines of sight. I see.
There's no magic involved. You have two.
But it's it may or may not be UV then. It's just
no.
But you can translate them into. UV.
Yeah, you can
translate them into.
GWAS, it's designed to be orthogonal.
Okay.
They're designed to be orthogonal.
Right. Okay. Any two components.
Yeah.
Rotate.
So in the real world, you have to you're assuming you can construct U and V from line of sight wind.
Right.
Yeah.
So let me go to the. Utility of Doppler wind LIDARs in cloudy conditions. This is FAST. This is something I prepared for Marty Ralph a while back. Wayman asked me to do it. But this whole issue of clouds and for aircraft as well as space-based. Now, aircraft, we're doing a lot of work with aircraft right now, and I want to save a little time at the end here to tell you what we're doing with the TPARC data because it applies to the Aussies. But in the total experiments, which was the airborne wind LIDAR that we flew for about 6 years out of Monterey, we're now upgraded to a P3. We just flew that through typhoons for 2.5 months out in off of Guam. So now that system's on a P3, or new system's on a P3. We can get around a little better. The ability to punch through clouds, particularly marine strat, has really amazed me. So we are getting information through what looks like opaque clouds, and we're getting enough shots with a coherent system, since we don't have to integrate shots, to get wind profiles, and I'll show you evidence of that. But does that apply to space? And that's where we're trying to use the airborne data to corral our somewhat optimistic view of what we're getting from a space-based system. So that's one of the driving reasons for taking airborne data, is to make sure our Aussies are being realistic. We've done a lot of work since 91. I did work over in France with Jennifer Saez, who did some work with the spot imagery. We were looking for cloud-free line of sights. So ever since 91, we've been trying to see just what is the global statement for cloud-free line of sight statistics. We were funded to do, we have a total, as I mentioned, Hardesty's flown some, and of course the DLR has their Falcon system. They were also flying that this late summer. And so we've got a lot of good data.
You weren't flying with them, right? They were flying out of Japan?
They were flying out of Japan. They were handling the recurvature phase and the
landfall.
The landfall, but flying out of Japan. We were flying out of Guam in the Genesis, and we actually got through an eyewall. We actually flew an eyewall with the P3 system. So. But then we hand that off. Evidence of utility is that we've had LIDARs in space. Light was an early one. Cloud-based penetration was somewhat obvious. GLASS showed it again, and now we have Calypso. Dave Winker and myself, I'm PI, and Dave Winker's co-I, and also Dave Battle from UAH, are funded by NASA to look at Calypso data in terms of its cloud-free line of sight statistics and its suggestions of backscatter distribution around the globe, as it applies to wind LIDAR. And this was for Marty, but you can look at any Calypso page or GLASS page, anything we've flown, dial flown on an aircraft, but go to space, and
you'll see plenty of times where there's cloud and you're getting aerosol returns and you're getting cloud returns and you've got cloud, and yeah, there's times where it's blanked out. But and these are pretty thick clouds, but there's still, all you need with a coherent system is just one or two of these shots and you've got your answer. Now, it's not as representative as something where you have a lot of shots, but you're still getting a measurement of the wind. So that was my message to Marty, is that 80% of all LIDAR shots seen, we came up this with looking at light and then glass, 80% of all LIDAR shots reach the ground and produce a ground return. Does not say they haven't been attenuated to the point where you can't get an aerosol return, so be careful, but 80% hit the ground and give you a return.
What's the power level of that laser compared to?
Much less than ADM. Okay. ADM is going to be a honker.
Well, ADM also looks to an angle, and glass is an nadir look.
Yeah, but that little bit of a nadir angle, you're talking about the shapes of clouds and all, but the attenuation lengths are a little longer.
Yeah, that's what
it's
I mean.
We've looked at that. It's not a big player, it's a player, but it's not a factor two or anything like that.
So, when your picture showed something, you can see the under the cloud.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, all right, I'm going to now stop with that one and show my last one very quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I want to get into Tom Schroeder's talk.
They can.
I just want to show this, and I'll leave it on here if you want to look at. It's the airborne Doppler wind LIDAR. It doesn't fit. There's something different about this. But anyway, I just want to show you this quickly because this isn't just to go out and look at typhoons. This was to, as it says in the title, to obtain long data sets for data impact studies related to future space-based Doppler wind LIDAR. The idea is to take a lot of data and then go back and thin it to represent what, say, ADM is going to get or what GWAS would get, and do impact studies. Now, I'm collecting the data against the funding to do the impact studies. There's no funding for this. This is just some data that's being collected. But we had long flight legs from the U.S. to Guam and Guam and back, and we had a lot of long 3-hour ferry flights, like 1,500-kilometer ferry flights. We're just nice, steady, taking data. And a lot of aerosols, a lot more aerosols than I ever thought we would get. Now, we have a good LIDAR, and a better LIDAR this time, but still more aerosol than I thought we would find above the marine boundary layer. This was for TPARC. This was a typhoon, tropical cyclone-focused program. And it's now on a P3. Slide number 4 just shows you the new installation, the new scanner. The LIDAR system's about a third the weight, third the power of the old total system. I'm going to skip on here. 6-7, again, was a study of tropical cyclogenesis and intensification based out of Guam. We had the C-130 and the DLR Falcon. Key point, drop sondes. And one of the things we're doing is, and this is what I hope we can do, is we were taking wind soundings prior to and after a drop sond. And I'm wondering what the advantage will be to take the drop sond data and assign it an observation error that's based on how representative it was in the wind field, but to use that to say this is a representative measurement or it's not a representative measurement. So you can use the mass field information from the ray obs better. I'd like to see if that is a possibility to try that. But and I'm sure we're going to be putting the drop sondes into models. Fleet Numerical is working on this, and I think NSEP will too. So that's one of the ways in which the wind LIDAR and aircraft could make the drop sond data more or less have more or less impact on the model forecast. Here's a map of where we were in Guam. We mainly worked this area. Sorry. We mainly worked this area here to the north. What did I do wrong? Up in here. This is the area we mainly worked. The Falcon was up in here.
So long ferry flights over water. And we collected over 171 hours of data, 18 missions into tropical cyclones. We got, I think, four cyclones. And here's the curtain of winds. 2,100 meters, 1,500 meters, I'm on slide 15, 500 meters, this is from the LIDAR, and 200 meters.
Meter means height?
Height above the ocean surface, and we're getting all those winds. And we have not filtered them, you're just seeing them in the rock, and I think these are real. This is a very confused area right here, is the eye.
This is a vector, right?
Huh?
A vector.
Oh yeah, we're measuring the wind from 12 different directions, not two. We use a 12-point step stair in our scan. All right. And we compare against the rayoffs, and I'm not going to. It's here for you to look at. I've got to get off the.
Yeah.
What are the plans for NWP impact experiments for this and the Falcon data?
And there is no
GMAO is going to do something, right?
There is no funding.
Well, GMAO was sponsored in terms of internal R&D.
Yeah.
To do something.
All right. So in summary. While this mission doesn't have much to do with Aussies directly, it wasn't funded by Aussies, I think it goes a long way to putting us in a position to comment on how realistic the Aussies are. And the one message I want to bring back is that in spite of all the clouds around tropical cyclones, and we were flying around them and through them, I still, looking at the data, say 85% of the time we were making...
What altitude were you flying at?
3,000 meters.
Okay.
We looked down and we looked up. The scanner can do both. We looked up successfully 10% of the time. We see something between ourselves and the next layer of clouds. We always get the winds of the clouds above us.
How high could you get a return looking up for each thing?
In some places we were looking up to around 14 kilometers. But we pulled that back in because we were taking a big hit on the data volume. We were kludged together with an old data system and a brand new laser. So we actually operated the system at a factor of 150 times less sensitivity than the system can provide. We had to. So I'm really anxious to take it out again with its full potential. All right, that's it.
So any prospect for using that T3 instrument in WSR 09?
09, no.
Okay.
That's off the table because somebody else...
Is that Ramesh's hurricane thing in 09?
No, that was the possibility.
Oh, the Winterstorm Reconnaissance Program.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay.
Okay, then now it sounds like we have to get a good result from airborne LIDAR.
Was it lack of funding or something?
So
no,
somebody else now we want to go to Tom's presentation. Shirata also talk 04 December 08 dot X. Dot X, that slide has a slide number inside.
Okay, Michiko. Again, we're doing the file that's called Schlatter Aussie Talk for December 08. And I'm starting with the title page. As many of you know, I'm going to retire at the end of this month. And I think it's for that reason that Michiko asked if I would like to share some ideas about global Aussies.
And we love your title.
Parting shots. It's an unintended pun. This is a really high-level talk, and I realize that I am preaching, for the most part, to the faithful, but bear with me. This runs about just 12 minutes if there's no discussion, but I expect there may be some. So if we go to the next slide, it's a homespun wiring diagram for global Aussies. You'll see three columns here on slide number 2. The column on the left has to do with nature runs and the generation of
synthetic observations from the nature run and the errors that get attached to the observations. The middle column has to do with the ASI itself, where we assimilate these synthetic observations and perform an assimilation prediction cycle, and then at intervals we depart from that cycle and produce forecasts, generally speaking, out to 5 days. We verify those forecasts against the nature run fields, or we could verify them against the simulated observation. Now, the right-hand column on this diagram has to do with calibration. In this case, we're using an operational system and real atmospheric observations. But the restriction is that we are using the same mix of observations as are to be used in the ASI itself. Again, we run an assimilation and prediction cycle, and at intervals we break off and produce forecasts that are longer, say out to 5 days. But in this case, we verify the forecasts against operational analyses or real observations. Then at the end, we compare what we got in the simulation column with what we get in the calibration column. And if we find that the statistical behavior of the assimilation system is similar in both the simulated and real worlds, then we say we have a properly calibrated ASI, and we have some basis for interpreting our results as credible. So if we go on to the next slide,
Tom,
slide 3.
Can I just interrupt you for a minute?
Yeah.
In the middle column in the simulation, I mean, you could verify the forecast against the ASI assimilation also.
Yeah.
That would be more similar to what you do in the real world.
Yes, it would. But one of the great advantages, of course, of having a nature run is that you have at least a definition of truth.
Well, I agree, but for calibration purposes, you may want to do what you do in the real world.
Yes, you could. I agree. I would also say that with reference to the middle and right-hand columns, it is a huge computational effort. It probably requires, 500 gigabytes to a terabyte of storage before you're all finished. But for the most part, you can turn the crank. And I think where the intellectual challenge is, the scientific challenge, is in the left-hand column, where you do the nature run, interpret its realism compared with the atmosphere, and where you try to extract the observations and produce realistic observational errors. So the part that's outlined in red here is the part that I'd like to dwell on for just a couple of minutes, the nature run and the generation of simulated observations from the nature run. So if we go to the next slide, we'll just concentrate for a moment on the nature run. Now, I think it's really a big deal that the European Center consented to run a 13-month simulation, a free forecast, running at 599 waves, triangular truncation, and 91 levels in the vertical. The model output is every 3 hours. They also ran 235-day, even higher resolution nature runs at T799, again 91 levels. We're on slide 4, and the output in this case is every hour. The first of these shorter runs was for the hurricane season, and the second one is for the spring convective season. This is a huge computational effort, which I suspect very few organizations could pull off, and fortunately for us, it does use the most accurate global model available today. Many of us in this group who specialize in different areas of atmospheric flows have helped to assess the realism of the nature run by comparing with known atmospheric behavior as described by statistics of various kinds, most relating to the general circulation and climate. A few discrepancies between the European Center's nature run and the real atmosphere have been uncovered. I know some of them are in the Arctic and Antarctic in the polar regions, and some are in the tropical regions. But by and large, I think we can say, safely that the Nature Run does mimic atmospheric behavior rather well. On the next slide, I just wanted to make a point about substituting for the Nature Run just described instead a succession of analyses, and why this not may not be a very good choice. There are three reasons for this. One, a series of analyses are too close to the real atmosphere and do not depart from it with time because they're based upon observations of the real atmosphere. A proper Nature Run should generate an independent alternative atmosphere, in effect, a parallel universe. Second reason is that these series of analyses are not connected by a smooth evolution of states. Every time we take a first guess, which is a model state, we may produce another model state, especially if we're using four-dimensional variational analysis, but that's a discontinuous jump between the first guess and a model state, which is the analysis. And in the real atmosphere, of course, it is a smooth evolution, and in the Nature Run that I described on the previous slide, it is a smooth evolution. And the third reason is that the observations contributing to the analyses are not evenly distributed, either in space or time. And so the analysis error varies from place to place. In a model-generated Nature Run, the truth is known uniformly everywhere. Let's go to the next slide now, slide 6, and talk a little bit about extracting observations from the Nature Run. Whenever we do an OSSI, we really should include all observation sources that are relevant to operational prediction. That means observations at the surface, over land and ocean. It means all kinds of sounding instruments, in situ and remote from the ground, and it includes satellite instrumentation, both from geosynchronous and low Earth orbit satellites. Plus, of course, the proposed new source for which the OSSI is constructed in the first place. If we neglect any of the operational sources that are relevant to forecast accuracy, then we are reducing the competition that the new observing source has to face. And in that sense, we are not doing a realistic job of things. So generating these observations from the Nature Run is a very labor-intensive effort. It involves many decisions about which forward models to use. How do we account for clouds? Because clouds, after all, determine in many cases whether we're going to have an observation or not. I refer specifically to cloud track winds or target tracking in satellite images. And there are other examples, too, where clouds are really important. So how we handle the Nature Run clouds with respect to the observations generated from the Nature Run is pretty important. We also have to worry about specifying instrument errors, both random and correlated, and representativeness errors, to take into account the difference between the grid volumes in the Nature Run and the actual volume being observed by observing systems. And careful documentation of all these things is essential. Before we move on, I want to point out that we've made a lot of progress in this, and previous meetings of this sort have reported results in these areas. And I think it is largely because of the cooperative effort that we have started. On the next slide, figure 7, I wanted to make a point made earlier. If the observational errors, those are the errors added to the true values that come from the Nature Run, if they have been specified properly, then the statistical behavior of the assimilation system will be similar in both the simulated and real worlds, and the OSSI is properly calibrated. If we find that, and we have found this to be basically true, I think, so far. But if it is not true, then the observation errors have to be adjusted. And as far as I know, there is no really good way to do this except by trial and error and making educated guesses about what we should try next. The next slide gets us into a little bit different discussion. I wanted to say a few words about regional OSSIs. One of the reasons that the European Center generated these T799 nature runs, 35 days each, was to obviate the need for regional Aussies. And, you know, depending upon how realistic we determine those very high resolution nature runs to be, we may decide we can use them for higher resolution experiments, or we may decide that we have to go to regional Aussies. I'd say that decision has still not been made. But if we do have to go to regional Aussies, they present their own set of problems, and I wanted to spend a minute or two discussing those. This little wiring diagram on slide number 8 indicates that we have to have two nature runs, a global nature run that feeds lateral boundary conditions to a regional nature run, and we have to conduct really two Aussie experiments, one with a global assimilating model, which feeds boundary conditions to a regional assimilating model. We have to generate simulated observations in both domains, the global and regional domains, and we have to insert those into our presumably operational assimilation cycles, or in any case, different assimilating systems than we used for the nature run. Next slide, slide 9, discusses some of the handicaps that we face if we choose to do a regional Aussie. The first and most serious is that lateral boundary conditions will influence and ultimately dominate the forecast inside the regional domain. They will eventually obscure any effect of the observation mix on forecast accuracy. And this is a severe limitation that has to be considered when we evaluate the Aussie. What it means is that in practical terms, is that the size of the geographical region really controls the length of forecasts that can be considered. If we have a smaller region in which we do our Aussie, we can only do shorter forecasts. Point number 3, in the ideal world, the same observation mix should be used in the regional model as in the global model that supplies the boundary conditions. So if I am capable of doing a regional Aussie, but not a global Aussie because I don't have enough resources, I have to get an agreement with somebody who can do global Aussies and persuade them, ideally now, to perform their Aussies with the same observational mix outside of my region that I want to use inside my region. And that's not always easy. We tried it once, and I think more or less succeeded with lots of help from EMC, but it's not something I would personally want to do very often. And finally, one is forced to execute two nature runs and coordinate two data assimilation and prediction systems in order to do a regional Aussie. The final slide is a couple of points that I would like to leave you with. The first is really a congratulatory point. I think the joint effort that we have conducted for Global Aussies has been a productive sharing of the strengths and the resources of the participants on the phone and some others who couldn't join us today. There's been a lot of progress, and I think that the infrastructure which is coming into being will soon enable us to do Global Aussies in a fairly efficient fashion, so that we don't take 2 or 3 years just to do one of them carefully. Point number 2, even full Aussies of the type I've described here are subject to many compromises, and the interpretation of results has to be done carefully. Anyone who chooses to ignore any of the major steps outlined for a full Aussie, I think, is inviting trouble and confusion in the ultimate interpretation of results. And finally, even 1% of the cost of an expensive observing system would constitute unprecedented funding for global Aussies. It would be a windfall for us and would almost surely be cost-effective. And I don't know that mindset is yet prevalent among those who are fielding, among governments who are fielding major observing systems.
I agree with you on that. How would $120 million to study NPOs?
Yeah,
well, compared to the budgets we discussed today, you know, we wouldn't know what to do with that kind of money.
Yeah,
right.
Tom, this is Wayman. You're really speaking to the choir on this point.
Yeah, well, I thought I would be, but, you know, every now and then, you know, there are ideas that come to the fore that are shortcuts, and all I'm trying to say is shortcuts may be necessary in some cases. They may be driven by events, but the interpretation of experiments conducted with shortcuts have to be taken very carefully.
Tom, this is Lars Peter. Thank you very much. I think this is a great summary. Do you have any plans to write it up in a narrative form and sort of leave us with a record of it? Because I think there are a lot of great points that I would certainly like to use when I go forward to lobby the AA levels and within NOAA to... I'm not going to shoot for 1% because that is just wildly unrealistic. But there's still,
well, I think even 1/10 of 1% would be quite a bit. Yeah,
we'd be golden. do you have any plans to write this up in any different fashion, or is this it?
Well, this is all I plan to do. This is a capsule summary, and if I put it in paragraph form, it might not sell as well to people that you have to talk to. I don't know. If it's really important to you, I could do something like that. But it wouldn't be much longer than this, and I don't think it should be.
Yeah. There is a spring chapter of Springer. It's sort of like documentation. Then it's maybe too long for some people.
Well, that's a good point. I think, you know, the Springer chapter on Aussies, which was a large group effort and was very difficult to get into the shape it's in today, went through probably more than 3 dozen iterations from start to finish. They seemed endless. But I think in the end, it's a pretty good summary and an elaboration of what was said here.
A lot more
details there.
That's a very good point. That is actually what I was looking for was something that I can reference. But this is it.
Yeah, that's right. 29 pages, including references.
Yeah.
So reference list is quite good as well. They're good reference
list. Hey, Tom. This is Dave.
Hi, Dave.
I wanted to go back and just reflect a little bit on your issue of representativeness in simulations. And almost your bottom line there was trial and error. I mean, if you think about how the observation error that's used in the cost function is generated, it's sort of that way. I mean, it's looking at just how much faith or how much emphasis or how to use a particular observation, how to compete against the first guess and so forth. And I don't add an observation error to the LIDAR wins. I mean, I don't add anything. I try to simulate subgrid scale variance and it just shows up in a number that's don't get me wrong. We have metrics that say here's the average for this grid scale for this model, and how does our answer deviate from that? We keep statistics on that, but the observation itself, I don't add representativeness error, because that has much more to do with the spacing of observations as well as the model's way of using that piece of information, how it smooths it, and so forth. So I was wondering what you had in mind. Are there people simulating observations that add representativeness?
Yeah, Rome provide a code to add observational error, that is random error. So
well,
that we can add.
I think that includes
representative error of the random representative error.
Yeah, I think Ron Erickson has thought about this a good deal, and others working with him.
So
the way I like to view representativeness error is the discrepancy between the grid volume, which the model can resolve, and in our case, what's relevant is the nature run grid volume, and the volume actually sampled by the sensor. Now, for satellite observations, in comparison, let's say, with a mesoscale model grid volume,
the satellite grid the satellite observed volume may actually be larger than the model grid volume, and in that case, it's an integrative observation, as opposed to what we would normally consider a point observation compared to a large grid volume in a model. But I think it's a discrepancy between the grid volume of the model and the volume observed by the instrument itself, which is at the heart of thinking about representativeness error. And traditionally, we do not separately provide a representativeness error and an instrument error. You know, laboratory calibrations might lead us to a number for instrument error, but the specification of representativeness error is largely a judgment call. And, you know, one great example is I've got a thunderstorm that's 3 kilometers wide, and unfortunately I have a grid volume that's 50 kilometers wide. What do I do with an observation stuck in the middle of the thunderstorm? It's grossly misrepresentative of what my model can resolve. So there's a lot of art, I think, to the specification of what I would call representativeness error.
Yeah, I'm glad you put it that way, because that's how I've been sensing it. And just one more question. What are your thoughts on what I was talking about earlier for these observations we took during T-Park, where there are drop sons, quite a few of them, but we were taking LIDAR wind profiles over the same volume. They're dropped from 10,000 feet. And we're sampling from 10,000 feet down. And we've got wind measurements every 3/4 of a kilometer, a complete wind profile.
But the drop zone profiles, I guess, are much less often, right?
Oh, yes, much
less
often.
What is it, like 10 to 1, 100 to 1, 50 to 1?
About 30 to 1, 25 to 30 to 1. And so the idea was to use the variance in the wind profiles to assign a representativeness error to the drop zones, both the mass and the wind.
I think that's a fair thing to do because, you know, with the with the LIDAR-based winds, you've got you resolve the spatial variability at a much smaller scale than you do with the drop zones. And it does give you some clue about the representativeness that a drop zone would have with reference to a much larger grid volume than either of the two observation resolutions.
It's not necessarily small.
Huh?
But the LIDAR wind, you take average of the scan.
Yeah, well, it's on a very small scale.
Yeah, there are, you know...
We're going 120 meters a second.
So,
yeah, there's the additional problem of, you know, deciding what the volume sampled is,
yes,
you know, with the LIDAR versus the volume sampled with a drop zone, and one is much larger than the other, probably an order of magnitude larger.
Yeah, and I would say that the LIDAR is giving you a better average of the winds over similar volumes because you're just taking more shots from different perspectives and you're moving. It's not simple. I'm just trying to get some opinions on whether it's worth pursuing where you have a dynamic weighting or observation error in your data assimilation. It's dynamic. I mean, it's not just assigning drop zones 3 meter per second observation error.
You mean everywhere you drop them?
Yeah, right. Doesn't matter where. We just take them in and assimilate them at 3 meter per second.
Well, what makes you think that any representative error that you calculate for any particular drop zone applies to any other?
No, but they would vary from one to the other.
They do, but
that's my point.
I mean, that's really a data assimilation methodology problem.
I guess I'm trying
and the modeling of observation error is not that sophisticated in most data assimilation systems yet. And so I view the data assimilation system as a boundary condition for the OSIs. We don't tinker with it. We just use whatever the operational guys use. And our job is to mimic the impact of our simulated observations. It has to look the same as the impact of the real observations in the real data simulation. You're right. You could make a case for having a highly state-dependent observation error variance modeling. They're not there yet.
Yeah, I think we're a long way off from that. I think we'd be lucky if we can get a crude representativeness error assigned to you know the simulated observations. We'd be lucky if we can do that.
I think if you do, if you're not doing it, then I think the observations are too, will be too optimistic in the end.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. You know, the random errors that we usually think of with regard to instrument are with regard to instrument errors, and those aren't big enough.
No,
in the real world,
in some cases they may be. I mean, Dave's case is somewhat atypical because he's actually simulating the observations. In many other cases, say the CloudTrack wins, it's really a stretch to say that we simulate the observations because we don't. We just sample the nature run where we think the observation should be. That's a very different ballgame than simulating lineup transfer.
Yes. Well, that gets back to the forward models we use and how much art there is involved even with those.
Okay. So other thing is still, I was very impressed about the result Ron Erica showed, similarity between real and simulated observation impact is so similar and very good. It means large amount of error come from model error. So that means why we can't do the identical twin also. So different error coming from the two different model is very mimicking the
Is Ron's presentation up on your website?
Yes.
Okay. If any of you haven't seen it, I encourage you to take a look at it. It's really impressive.
It's still, this is fast shot. It's, he said he got all the results at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He looked at result only a few days, so even Lu Ha hasn't seen that slide when she came to the presentation.
I think we found out in the 1993 experiments that you have to look at the fits to data. You have to look at the forecast scores, and basically you turn the observation error to levels that give you comparable results. It's not brain surgery at that level. The empirical tuning technique is really just that. I mean, your observation error, including both representative and instrumental error, that the sum of those two is what you have to work with.
Yeah, and in practice, of course, what we have to deal with is OBS minus first guess, or O minus F.
Yeah,
and that's a combination of all three errors: model error and representativeness and instrument.
Absolutely.
And the other thing is, in one of the slides you mentioned about we can't use analysis as a major run. I think analysis has forced by observation itself. So atmosphere is attractive towards observation. That doesn't happen in the real world.
Sorry?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are pros and cons, both using forecast models and analysis for a nature run. One really good thing about using an analysis as a nature run, I mean, after all, you're taking something that isn't truth, either way, and saying it is.
Right.
Okay, I mean, so whatever you end up with is what you are calling the truth. The great thing about an analysis is all the data is in the right place, if that means anything.
And the clouds are real.
The clouds are all there. The clouds are all located by the CloudTrack wind observations. The aircraft are flying in the jets the way they're supposed to. That's all good. And that's something we haven't even tackled. Those particular problems in the forecast nature run.
So
we don't have a set of observations that come, you know, in the right places that come with a forecast nature run.
So one thing is it's important when you use analysis kind of things as a nature run, there are no data, real data should be involved in analysis.
Well, no,
where,
it should
in
be sampled
area,
in the same
tested.
Way, right? Absolutely. True.
So like William LaHotte justified using analysis as nature run because he was working on stratosphere and he removed the data from stratosphere. So that kind of thing is people tried. But well, those don't want to use analysis because we don't have MJO and that kind of thing.
Or QBO maybe.
QBO.
SAO.
My argument is one of the slides I prepared on the future nature run, next generation nature run I prepared. The people try to fix the existing model by adding some realistic forcing for tropics, something, but now we are start getting fairly realistic MJO in a real model. Like, for example, slide number 11, for the left is observed and the right is completely free run from the model run, 1 year integration, coupled model. So MJO is even getting better. Still, QBO is not generated by model. So that's the other thing. So the nature run we are using right now doesn't have that kind of behavior. We don't.
So how long is the forecast there?
This is 1 year. 1 year integration.
T62.
Yeah, T62. So this one is T15. Slide number five, T59. This is European Center model. This is left side is observed, and right to five slide is five different generation of forecast model.
This is 1 month.
This is 1 month integration. So development from our model is somewhere around here. Our nature line is cycle 31. So our model is cycle 31 R1, so third from the right. The current model is cycle 32 R3, so MJO is getting quite good. So fiddling around some realistic feature is better, or maybe model improvement might catch up. So that's other things.
Well, it never fixes the data location problem.
Yeah.
Unless it actually looks just like the analysis.
Well, but the forcing by observation in an RC system is a serious problem.
Well, but not having the, I would argue the opposite, the other side, not having the observations in the right place could be a serious problem. I mean, in terms of evaluating relative skill of mm-hmm. different observing systems. If the aircraft aren't really observing the jet, you're missing a big piece of quality.
We have to simulate aircraft accordingly.
I'm just saying that hasn't been done.
Yeah,
it's a tough problem that you don't have if you use analysis.
Hello. Hi, this is Ken Sirk.
Excuse me.
Oh.
It's noon. So do we have to get off from
next
the
meeting?
So next meeting will be January 30th. Friday. This will be Friday afternoon.
Oh, so that's when Gert-Yang will be here.
Yeah, Gert-Yang will be here. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, well, you have a good day.
Yeah.
Can you go to the top of
the speaker? Yeah, 2 minutes. Dave, I'll be here. Okay.
You know, the entire system, I run. So we started with the forecast. We do the forecast from 12Z.